I have exciting news.
What's that?
Oh, no. You're pregnant.
No, fuck no.
No. Hello, and welcome to Fiction Between Friends, a podcast dedicated to books and book lovers like us. I'm Josephine Angelini.
I'm Lauren Sanchez.
I'm Alyssa Hilfinger.
And I'm Aileen Calderon.
We're four childhood friends from the suburbs of Massachusetts.
We've always loved to read, almost as much as we love to talk to each other.
We started this podcast as a way to celebrate how a really good book can come into your life and change it.
So if you're looking for fun and engaging conversations about books, stick around.
This is Fiction Between Friends, and we're glad you've joined us. Hello there. Welcome to our podcast. This is episode 4, season 1. I'm Josephine Angelini, and joining me are my dear friends, Aileen Calderon.
Hi there. Alyssa Hilfinger.
Hi, friends.
And Lauren Sanchez.
Hello.
So before we talk about books, how is everyone doing this week?
So I took Wyatt to the library and got him a library card.
Yay!
I told him we could go to the bookstore and buy one book, and he said, but I want lots of books, and I'm not going to buy him lots of books. So I was like, wait a minute. We have a library. We can go there. The librarian was so excited to see us and have us there. And I asked her, like, how many books can we take out? And she answered me. And I was like, okay, 5. And she said, no, 50.
Oh,
and I
yeah.
was like, really?
Yes. Yeah. At our library, it's 99.
Why I heard 50 and just started like grabbing books off the shelves. So I had to like put a halt to it and tell them.
Oh, okay, I love it. I love it.
I'm not going to read all of these, but
it helps the library statistics. Just keep taking them.
Wait, really? What do you mean?
Oh, yeah. We keep statistics about how much circulates, how many items circulate a month.
Wait, because I was actually thinking, how do libraries choose the books that are on the shelves? Because the library seemed to have like a really interesting selection of children's books. And I assume it's not random that there's some thought and process that goes into it.
There is. Sometimes it is random. But we read journals for reviews like School Library Journal or Horn Book. Those are the two big ones.
So how does that impact like the publishers and the authors? I mean, does it count as a sale for the author?
Yep. It's very important. Your distributor and your publisher will be putting your book in all these catalogs for people to buy it.
Yeah.
And that counts to your first week sales. If you're recommended by librarians and librarians say that, you know, we're all going to buy this book. And they actually have these huge meetings and these dinners where you go and you
meet.
Oh,
yeah.
Like, yeah, it's like your publisher will take an author to meet the librarians. And
so librarians are like the original influencers.
They get their sources. They get recommendations from all over the place. There are a lot of people who, you know, they do a lot of their own reading before they order. And there are, well, Lauren, you know more about this than I do, but all that I know is from the author's perspective is going to, you know, they have like these big dinners and you sit down and you sit and talk with a bunch of librarians.
Never been invited to those.
Can we talk about your publishing imprint? Are we allowed to talk about that? Is that okay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, we can talk about it. I haven't quite signed the deal yet, but I'm gonna. We're like inches away from it. It's kind of like, seriously, if I get it tomorrow, I'm just going to sign it and be like, cool.
Don't let them know.
I know this isn't coming out for a few weeks anyway, so it'll be done by then.
Wait, but yeah, I feel like we've talked about it, but what made you do? Because I also, because I'm back on the Twitter because of this podcast, I saw and following
the Twitter.
Bookish people. The government just blocked 2 publishers merging. It seems like authors
Simon
are really...
and Schuster and Penguin. Yeah,
oh, those House are Penguin. Huge publishers.
Yeah, see the big five. They're the big 5, and to drop down to the big 4, you really are starting to get close to this monopoly. And I mean, I don't know all the details about that. I don't know what it was, but there was a huge outcry because it was record profits for Simon and Schuster. But the authors were like, that doesn't change my deal with them at all. So where are these profits going? Like, is it helping the authors? Is it helping promote our books? Is it getting is this doing anything for us so that we can sell more books and make more money? But I mean, there's really nothing, there's no authors union. There's nothing to protect us. There's nothing, we don't even know. It's sort of forbidden to even talk about how big your deal was or how much money you're getting per book or what your cut is or how much you get out of your e-sales or your audiobook sales. Like talking about the details of when do you earn out? Earning out is your publisher lets you know when you've sold enough copies to cover your advance, but you never, they're the ones who control the numbers. They're the ones who get the numbers reported to them from book sales. Then they sort of let you know whenever they feel like it, when you can start making royalties.
It doesn't sound very transparent.
It's not transparent. And it's kind of this rotten deal where it's like they take the lion's share of your profits forever, you know? When I first got into this, it made sense. Like, your publisher did so much to get your book out there, and they fought for your book, and they were pushing your book into people's hands and pushing your book into people's faces. Now it's all social media. So your publisher looks at you and they're like, so how are you going to promote your book? And you're like, well, wait a minute.
Right. What are you going to do for me then?
Exactly. Yeah. It starts to be this really, I don't understand what they're there for anymore. Like,
yeah.
It just got to this point where I was like, if I'm doing all this work, basically all you're doing is printing up my book.
So wait, so is this a huge risk for you, or is it?
If you're working with a distributor, they do the same thing. They get your books into catalogs. They make it, they put it in front of librarians so that they can order it. And they do all the stuff that a publisher would do. The only thing is that I have to hire my own editor. I've got to pick my own book cover. I've got to, you know, do all of that other stuff. And I do assume a certain amount of risk because I have to pay for the initial print run. If you want to do hardcovers and paperbacks, you actually do have to have an initial print run.
So it's not something a new author would do. Like, you have to be pretty well established and have a reader base to go off and...
Unless you had a following in another way.
Right. Everything is so multimodal now.
Yep.
It's insane how much influence social media has on everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does your imprint have a name yet?
Sungrazer. Sungrazers are the comets that get really, really close to the sun. And they either burn up
horribly. They have a catastrophic death. Exactly.
But let's be a little more optimistic.
Yep. Or they put into an accelerated orbit. So they either, but they're very bright. They're very beautiful. They either die horribly or they go super fast. So I was like, yeah, that sounds like the situation I'm in right now. So Aileen, what book did you pick this week?
I got away from vaginas this week. I went for some testosterone. The Chocolate War by Robert Cormier, which I actually don't think I've met anyone else who's ever read this book, which surprises me because it's
I read it.
Oh, you have? Okay. I feel like everyone's like, what's that book? A long time ago.
Yeah, we read it in school.
Yeah.
Okay. I loved it.
Well, we read I Am the Cheese. So which is one of his other books.
Yes. And I remembered I Am the Cheese because I honestly couldn't remember the name of this book, but I remembered it was by the author who left his phone number at the end of a book. And he left his personal phone number at the end of I Am the Cheese. Like, it was back in the day where you could do that. And he would actually take calls from readers, which is, in this day and age, amazing and crazy and all that. But
and to add on to that, he's local.
He's from Leominster.
He's from Leominster.
No way. He wrote for
the Fitchburg Sentinel his entire career. And I work with his nephew. So,
no way.
Yeah, the department of my department head is his nephew. And I've talked with him about his uncle and the book. And and the whole phone number situation where Mike would talk about, my uncle would get these phone calls. But he loved writing and he loved the kids and but he's a local guy.
But it's kind of the same now because people can reach out to you on Twitter.
Yes, true.
It's like you can hang up if somebody's crank calling you or saying terrible things about your book. You can't like erase what somebody's tweeted about you. So it's actually even worse now.
That's true. It's more permanent.
People are expected to have your quote unquote phone number now. So anyway, keep going.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
So this book is awesome. I know I read it when I was little. I didn't remember it. I reread it. It is about a kid who refuses to participate in a school fundraiser. That is the plot, which sounds like it's not going to be an interesting book. And it is. It's just an amazing book. It takes place at a boys' Catholic school. I feel like as soon as you say Catholic school, you know, like evil, bad things are going to happen. So can I read you I think I sent you guys a screenshot of the opening. I just want to read the first couple sentences because it just kind of like gives you a sense of the tone of the book. So it starts, they murdered him. As he turned to take the ball, a dam burst against the side of his head and a hand grenade shattered his stomach. So they're talking about him playing football. But right there, it's just the whole book is really dark and violent. It's about all of these boys in this school. And there's like this secret society called the Vigils. And they basically control everything within the school. Like they basically If they tell you to pull a prank and you're a student, you do it. Like, they work with the teacher. The teachers know they have power. So there are constantly all these like power struggles between the teachers and the secret society and the students. And in this book, the main character decides the society tells him not to participate in this fundraiser, which has become incredibly important in the school. He does it, but then he's only supposed to refuse for the first couple of weeks. But for some reason, he decides he's just going to keep refusing to participate. So he basically is defying the school. He's defying the secret society and is just going rogue on his own for kind of unknown reasons. It's just, it's really about, I don't know, like the cruelty of kids and specifically boys and especially as teenagers. And I think what's so interesting is the boys get really like physically violent. Like they're cruel, they're violent, they're mean. And there's just something very animalistic about it. And I think about that versus like other books which have girls or even just thinking back to high school, like with girls, it tends to be a little more like psychological warfare, you know, like the kind of messing your mind. And yeah, it's a little more personal and like these boys, it just gets to like this very, very basic, like cruel level. But the book is, the descriptions are amazing. It's so well written. It's, and it just kind of sucks you into this sort of very carnal world. And the other thing I found interesting about it is it makes me sad to be a grown up because these little boys just like look at their parents and they're like, oh my God, what pathetic lives you live. Like, there's this other section. The thing about this book is there are just so many great like sentences and phrases that jump out at you. So I'm just going to read another part, which normally I wouldn't do, but it's just so profound. So Jerry is thinking this. Was this all there was to life after all? You finished school, found an occupation, got married, became a father, watched your wife die, and then lived through days and nights that seemed to have no sunrises, no dawns, and no dusks, nothing but gray drabness. I was like, oh God, that's like,
oh yeah, that's terrible. That's very Catholic.
See, Josie, I need really to the Catholicism in it. So the book is very dark. It's interesting because Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was on banned book list because it talks about menstruation. This one also has been banned a lot because it's so violent. Like there's actual blood that's not period blood. And then the ending is not happy. And people had a really hard time with the fact that it wasn't a happy ending. And actually, the author, there's a footnote to him in the end of the book. And he talks about he had a really hard time selling the book because there were publishers that wanted him to change the ending or change other things that he felt were important to the story. He flat out refused and eventually found a publisher who believed in him and got it written and, you know, won all kinds of awards. But
and it was read in schools. I mean, that's where I read it. I read that and I read I Am the Cheese. I don't remember how old we were when ninth grade.
I vaguely recall that in eighth grade. I Am the Cheese, eighth grade.
Yeah.
That and Flowers for Algernon. And I always mix those two up. But
yeah, but Aileen, why did you pick this one? Like, was it just because you were like, I remember it was good and I want to reread it?
You know what's funny? It's always stood out in my mind. Like when we were first talking about starting this and I wrote down all the books I could think of, this was one of them. I honestly didn't remember a single thing about it. But there was something about it that just kind of stayed in my psyche. And maybe,
flagged.
Yeah. And maybe because, I don't know, it's kind of fascinating hearing about the secret lives of boys, you know, and how evil they could be. And it's also just really beautifully written. It was actually based on the author's son actually refused to participate in a school fundraiser the author didn't say why, but for whatever reason, his son was like, I'm not going to participate. And his parents supported him. And that was the end of it. There wasn't anything. But the author basically took that and then turned it into this like incredible traumatic story.
And on the flip side, I thought of Dead Poets Society as like the more positive complement where you have these private or you know, these elite societies that, you know, the boys can become a part of. And then, you know, they have these clubs. But I think anytime you have a school in which kids pay tuition, you have the potential for that power dynamic between the teachers and the administration who are supposed to be running the school. And then the kids and the parents who say, ah, yes, but I pay you. So you do what I tell you. And I and that's just a basis of observation, of fact, you know, just the potential for a power dynamic. I'm not saying it exists, but it's got to have existed where that's been taken advantage of.
That's I can see that. There are parents who are like, I'm paying money for a product, basically. And if it's not at my level and what I want it to be, then I'm going to be upset versus something that you get for free. And you're like, well, I guess I'll just take it as it is. And also, I feel like there's a certain, I mean, there's a level of privilege that comes with being able to pay for your child to go to school somewhere. So it's different types of people.
So why would you recommend this book? Like, what if somebody were to like, hey, Aileen, what should I read next and why should I read it? Like, would you give this to any friend or would it be like a really specific suggestion to someone?
Oh, that's a good question. Why am I making it sound terrible? It's not a terrible
It's like... Like, I'm sitting here thinking, would I enjoy that book? There are lots of books I decide to read them because I want to get wrapped up in the language. There are books that I read just for fun, like totally for fun. There are other books that I read because you have to read them because, you know, everybody knows that book and you don't. You're the ding dong who hasn't read it. But like, where does this book fit into like you're suggesting it to people? Like how would you just be like, no, you have to read this because it's just so well written. It's like on another level, or it made me aware of something socially that I wasn't aware of before, or blah, blah, blah.
That's so interesting. Cause I'm thinking like who I would recommend this to. I think it's actually good for teenagers to read because I think every teen has the ability to be cruel somewhere within them. And I feel like just being aware of the fact that you could be so like, you need to think for yourself. And that's what the main character does. He stands up for what he believes in. And defies the teachers, the like secret society who runs the school. And he just, no matter what they do to him, he stands up for what he believes in. And you side for him and you root for him. But you can also see how the other kids who are going along with this like gang, you see how they get swept up in that and how they start just behaving that way because they feel like they have to and it's what everyone else is doing. And I think that's just a very true thing for teens. I think it's true for adults too. I think. Honestly, every phase of life, you get caught up in groupthink and doing what everyone else does and what you think you should do. Like, I live in the suburbs now and I'm buying my first pair of Uggs and I'm like, this is awesome. I can wear sweatpants all the time. I can look like a slob. That's what moms do. I'm going to do it. So it's a positive thing, I think. But it's still like that, like feeling okay. And like when I was living in the city, I was never into fashion, but, you know, become aware of like what everybody else is wearing and doing. And you sort of, even if you're your own person and do your own thing, you're still influenced by what everyone around you is doing. And this book just puts it to the extreme. I mean, it gets really harsh, but you read it and you're like, yeah, I could totally see that happening. So I think it just puts things into perspective. It's also just really well written. It's just a great book.
Okay, cool.
Okay, I'm Lauren. So excited. I'm going to interrupt you and say I cannot wait to start talking about my book because it goes hand in hand with Aileen's.
Oh, so Lauren, do you mind if you can put your knitting down later? You can pick it back up and then we can go to Alyssa first.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, Alyssa. She was like, I can't wait 1 second longer. I got to get in there.
They are so similar. They are incredibly similar. So only boy characters. It's a group of kids. It's incredibly violent.
What did you read?
So I read Lord of the Flies.
Yes. I was thinking about that while Aileen was talking and I could not think of the title.
And the reason why I picked it was because my son in 10th grade is reading it now. Mm. He had just finished reading it. And I distinctly remember sitting in Mr. Hergesheimer's class and Kelly bursting out, wait, who's Jack and Roger? As we were trying to keep track of all the
names. Oh my God, I remember that too.
Right?
Oh yeah, I remember hearing about that.
You know, and then dissolving into sophomoric laughter over the Jack and Roger.
That's hysterical.
And I was talking with my mom about this today, in fact, and this was one of the books that she read her first year in college. And so part of the conversation was, the fact that kids younger and younger are reading this. And it's about a group of boys who are stranded on an island somewhere in the Pacific. And they're maybe like 12 at the oldest, but it never occurred to me to think, oh, this is not representation because it's only boys. Like I think if you were telling a true story, like The Chocolate War or Lord of the Flies, where it is an isolated group or a very specific group that is meant to describe just that group, you're much more willing to fully embrace, you know, how monochromatic the representation is, because that's what the story is about.
That's a great point. Yeah.
This book really bothered me. I'm shocked that kids in 10th grade read it. But I think reading it as an adult, I process it so differently than I would have as a kid, because as a kid, I could only access it from what I knew. So I believe in World War I, there were a series of evacuations of students from some European islands, or an island off Guernsey Island. And I thought this was related to the kids that were evacuated from that. So I was initially picturing this as a World War I, but then when I read about it, this was meant to be like a World War III, kids being evacuated from a nuclear attack. I don't think that really plays a part into understanding what happens on the island, but this could have happened in the past. It could happen in the future. It really is timeless in that sense. And so it's this group of British boys who range in age, let's say from like 12, those are the biggins, down to the littleins, which are maybe like kindergarten, first, second, third grade. And some of the kids know each other, and they clearly come from the same group. And then other kids have no idea who each other are. Plane gets shot down as this evacuation is trying to happen. Half the plane slides down the mountain on the island that it lands on, goes into the sea. Everyone in that half of the plane are dead. And the rest of the kids kind of are scattered about the island. And then one of the characters, Ralph, gets the conch, which is a shell that he can blow in. And the kids scattered about the island hear this sound, realize that it's being made by a person. Everybody congregates. And so everybody comes together. And that's when people decide who's going to be the leader, what type of organization, and they create sort of a society with a couple of rules, such as they know they need food, they know they want to have fun, they want to try and keep some levity, and they need a fire. That's what's ultimately decided by Ralph. They really need a signal fire so that if a ship passes by, they can be rescued. And as the story unfolds, time passes, but you don't quite know how much. You know, they talk about how the scar that was created down the side of the mountain where the plane slid, the scar has been overgrown by vines and the forest has retaken it. And the boys now all have long hair and they're wearing the remnants of their schoolboy uniforms. And then there were pigs, wild pigs. As a scientist and ecologist, I have no idea how wild pigs could be on this island. I mean, they're herbivores. And I think part of it is the brutality in which the hunting group enjoys hunting and the violence around the hunting. It's not a respectful approach to this animal is going to sacrifice its life so that I can sustain mine. It's more this savagery and wildness and violence.
Yeah.
And the pinnacle event happens. It starts with a big hunt. They identify all the pigs that are down at the shoreline, and the sow is feeding all of her piglets. And that's the cow, the pig that they identify that they want to slaughter because it's the biggest. And so that's the one they go after. And I'm thinking, like, as a mother, no, don't hurt that pig. It has all its piglets. And then as a survivalist, I'm like, you idiots, you just killed all those piglets who now can't grow up to be more food for you. So I was so tense reading the book. I mean, I was in knots because the final scene is them hunting one of the other kids. It's so disturbing. And I asked my son if he liked the book, and he was like, yeah, it was good enough to read. And my son's not a reader, but he, you know, he liked it enough. He was able to tell me about it. He said, thankfully, he probably identified with Ralph, who was like the one who, you know, was the most grounded and the one who really was trying to make all these good decisions and bring people together. But so my last point about it is I went and I talked with one of our English teachers, and I said, why do you keep reading this? And he said that it's very difficult to find young adult books that not only kids can relate to, right, which we've talked about in the past. You need to be able to see yourself or at least relate to a character. And that gives you more buy-in to the book. But my English teacher friend was saying, not only do the kids see themselves or at least see a group of their peers, but it's really well written so that it's dense, it's thick, there's lots of symbolism, there's complex sentences. It takes effort to read it.
Ooh, are we finally unraveling the mystery of what's in literature?
Right. And he said,
maybe.
Well, maybe.
Well, it has elements.
Right.
Elements.
It's not simplistic writing. It's complex. And that gives the English teachers something to teach about. It's not just the characters, but it's the way it's written. It's the way the story unfolds.
I've always wondered if anyone, like any psychologists, have ever stopped and broken down whether or not that's probable, whether or not it's probable that a group of kids would devolve to that point where they're murdering each other and chasing each other, you know what I mean? And killing each other with sticks, basically.
Right. So the author never intended it to be this way. I was reading about, you know, just the history. I just looked up Lord of the Flies, Wikipedia, the history of the author, and his original book was meant to be a rebuttal of what he thought was not a realistic portrayal of kids abandoned on an island that, I forget the name of the book, but it was more like a, you know, sort of happy, fun time, everyone, you know.
Like a Peter Pan situation.
Exactly.
Oh.
And so he wanted to write something a little more realistic. And when he started, you know, shopping it around, the publisher said, no, we don't like this. And he finally found an editor. He ended up taking out the entire first part of the book, which was more about the World War III nuclear evacuation. And ultimately, he ended up saying, you know, I can't even bear to read the book that is been produced. It's not really what I had meant. So I don't know how much of this was created because it's so fantastical and it sucks you in. I mean, it's a compelling story, but I don't know that it was ever written with the intent of this could really, really happen.
And that goes back to our earlier discussion about publishers and their influence and what happens when there's only like, you know, five groups of people deciding what everyone reads. I also wonder, what's the story if it was a group of girls? How would that be different? So I do wonder, like Lord of the Flies female edition,
right,
what would that be?
I'm going to braid the hell out of your hair. You sit down, you're getting another ponytail.
Okay, so my book is not on that level. It's, somebody said simplistic. It is so simply written and so just escapist reading. It's almost like kind of weird to talk about it after talking about those.
It's a palate cleanser.
Yeah.
No. So this is our palate cleanser because I'm going to do Dune, and that's super dude-ish too. So yours is the palate cleanser.
I should have invited Anna to join us because she's what I call the Dune head. She's so into it. She's also into that Chalamet kid.
Timothy.
So she
isn't into him.
I know.
Has chemistry with everyone. It's weird.
He does. Anyways, this book, we have at work at the library, we have a magazine bin where people can give and take magazines. And somebody had thrown a book in there. And I was like, oh, well, I better take that out and send it upstairs. Maybe they'll put it in the collection. But then I ended up keeping it. It's brand new. It's A Season for Second Chances by Jenny Bayless. It's an escapist read. It's about community. It's about tradition. It's about finding who you are in your life.
So what happens in the book? Give us a quick spoiler-free summary.
Oh, yes. Spoiler-free. Okay, you know. But it's about this woman who catches her husband cheating on her. But she's had it at this point. She's like, I'm done. This has happened before. I'm done. It's very funny. So the husband, they own a restaurant together, and he's, you know, having sex with his waitress on a table. In the restaurant. Okay, I know. And I have kids in the house, so I'm trying to be really delicate about this. But you know, what's that expression?
There are so many expressions going through my head right now, Lauren.
I know. On a pillow sitting on the sofa was that like carry on.
Keep calm and carry on.
Carry on. Thank you very much. It's all over the place. Why can't I think of it? Anyways, while this is all going on, she's noticing this pillow in the background that says that. And it's just like the whole irony of it, you know? So she leaves him. She goes and holes up in a hotel for a while and has her, you know, cry out, her depressed, you know, doesn't shower for days. And then she reemerges and she ends up moneyless because her husband had frozen the bank account because he thought she'd go out and like spend it all or something. Ends up becoming like a guardian of somebody's home for 6 months while this person is away, and has some conflicts with the person's nephew, who she eventually falls in love with.
Of course.
Of course.
It's very Mr. Darcy.
It is. That's exactly what it's very Colin Firth. Like, I can't get him out of my head.
That's not a bad thing.
He's the character, John. So her name, I should tell you, her name is Annie. But they also have a book group, you guys. So she meets these wonderful women, supportive women, strong women, and they form a Victorian book group. So they read books by Victorian authors, and they meet in this, what once used to be a tea house, in part of the property. So she ends up being a restaurant owner and a chef, opening up her own cafe. And it's about the struggles between her, the man, you know, what's going to happen to the property. She wants to buy it. She's getting a divorce. You know, there's nothing to this book that is going to make you like go to bed and think about it. Okay. You're going to go to bed and fall asleep. It's so relaxing to read. You giggle. And it's the perfect time of the year to read this because it takes place in the fall and ends in Christmas time. There's no symbolism. It's probably not considered literary, but I've enjoyed giggling over it. And I look forward to reading it as, you know, as my kind of escapist thing, you know, at night, just to get away from everything. So I recommend reading books like this on occasion. Basically.
What was That's the title awesome. Of it again?
Season for Second Chances by Jenny Bayliss. It's a fast read.
I think there's something interesting about the fact that I think a lot of women like these like romance novels and movies where they're very predictable. Like
it's super predictable.
That whole trope where like they hate each other and you're like, but they're going to fall in love with you. You know what's going to happen, but there's something very reassuring and nice about it.
There's a buildup of tension, sexual tension, and you're like, yeah, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Then it doesn't because the phone rings, you know? But you know the good things are going to happen at the end. Nobody's going to get hurt or die, and you're not going to feel sad about it. You're not going to go to bed at night like worrying about it. But the characters are likable, you know, even if they're not supposed to be, they're still likable. Like that soon to be ex-husband is still likable, you know, in his own goofy way. I had chosen a different book for this week. It's a book I've read. It's a book I really like. I sat down to read it and I couldn't get past the first chapter. I was like, this is just too much. So you have those moments in your life where you just can't internalize it. And that's where I am. So.
Well, I just got my butt all the way through Dune. Do you know it's almost a 200,000 word book?
I do now.
So to an author, that means something to me.
Yeah.
What is that in pages?
That's like an 800 page book. 800, 900 pages.
Yeah. My daughter just finished reading it and she loved it.
I love it too. And I've read Dune before. The first time I read Dune, mm-hmm. I tried too young. I was like, what the hell is this? Here's the weirdest thing about Dune. In terms of science fiction, it's like this cornerstone book now. Like we understand it as being part of, it's very canonical. Like everybody knows Dune. In fact, it's the best selling science fiction novel of all time now.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. So Dune came out in 1965. And Frank Herbert, the author, he was 45 when the book came out. And he had written a few pulp adventure stories. He'd published a few novellas and even like a couple of novels. But at the time, he didn't really do sci-fi. Like there just wasn't that much sci-fi around in the 40s and the 50s. And he started really getting into sci-fi like in the mid to late 50s. And his first novel was about a conflict over oil consumption. Like he was almost prescient in the fact that he understood that at some point there were going to be wars. And he had this submarine. I think it was like a submarine story where there's this war going on in the world over oil. And Dune kind of picks up on that. Like Dune is about spice trade and spice is necessary for space travel, the spice melange. And it's only produced, it's a psychoactive chemical that's produced on only one planet in the universe. And this is far, far in humans' future. It's 10,191 or something like that. But it's way far in the future. It's only produced on one planet. Thousands of planets have been explored and settled by humans, but it's all an empire. So there's one emperor, and then there are all these people who own planets. And then there's the Spacing Guild, which is like this super powerful corporation. It's called the Chome Corporation. And it's all about getting profits and spice. And then there's this other group. They're called the Bene Gesserits, and they're called witches. And they're these women who've been doing this secret breeding program. You have like this religious aspect that goes with the Bene Gesserits. You have this money aspect with the Chome. Then you have like this patriarchy with the empire. And he kind of gets all of this together in one of the clearest, most unique, and interesting world-building situations I've ever read. The book has no structure. Like, it's completely structureless. It's kind of like you go into it and you're like, I have no idea what's coming up next. And it ends like he just basically got to the bottom of the page and went, and I'm done. So it's like, but what he is just absolutely remarkable at is this world building. This is why it's like a cornerstone of science fiction, but at the same time, it's so unique. Like, there's literally nothing else out there that's kind of like it. So the history behind Dune is that he got the idea while he was writing a magazine article about the Oregon Dunes. And he did all of this research and never even published the article. His wife, who was also a writer, she was an ad exec. And so she was like writing jingles, and she had enough money to kind of support them so he didn't have to work, so he could write full time. This book was passed on by 20 different publishers before he finally got it kind of sort of first published in installments. Like, somebody agreed to do it, and then one person fell in love with the book and gave him a $10,000 advance. I mean, it was done in this really weird, weird, weird manner, put together over time. But as soon as it came out, it won the Hugo, it won the Nebula, and it was like not a commercial success, but it won all of these huge sci-fi awards. So it took like another 10 to 15 years before it built up to the point where it was like a commercial success. And then like it took 20 years before people were even thinking about, you know, until it was made into a movie. So it took like a really long time for Dune to take off because it's such a complicated book. And yet it's still considered this like a cornerstone of science fiction. Herbert, the author, he was really into mushrooms.
Psychedelic
mushrooms. he used to grow them. Yeah, no, because the spice melange is a psychoactive drug. Like, certain people, when they take this drug, they can see the future, they can see the past, they can go back through lifetimes, forward and back, like their descendants and all that stuff. So he's this mushroom eating guy who spent way too long studying ecosystems. And he was also super into Zen Buddhism. So like, he studied Zen Buddhism, he took mushrooms, he had this problem
with money.
Do you think
he was just high the entire time he was writing?
The book is pretty trippy, but it's not like, I don't think he was ever like that. In fact, he got asked by a lot of people if he had this super fanatical following. He still does.
Yeah.
And to the point where it was almost, there were people trying to put together this religion because he had like the Bene Gesserits that are in the book, and how they have all of these sayings. Like, there are a lot of religious tropes in the book, like, I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. There are all of these things that they chant. They're almost like mantras. And so people were trying to sort of create like this pseudo religion. And he got asked a bunch of times if that was what he was doing, if he was trying to make a cult. And he was like, what? Like, no, this is not at all. Like, I'm not trying to cultify anyone or get anybody to use drugs or anything like that. He backed away from that. He was like, this is not a cult. This is like, I was doing this thought experiment on ecosystems and it's financial
brilliant
systems. And, you know, he was like, and he brought religion into it, but he never uses God with a capital G, except like at the very end of Dune. Paul says, God created Arrakis to train the faithful. And that's the only time that I ever saw God with a capital G. Even when talking about the Bene Gesserits, they never talk about religion or right and wrong or a moral system. They have these certain powers, like they're capable of certain things, like the voice, they can control people. Their whole point was to create the Kwisatz Haderach, who's the...
Like, I'm sorry, say that again?
So the Bene Gesserit.
The quizza what?
The Kwisatz Haderach, which is they're a super being who can see the future, like really far into the future, see into the past and see into the place where women cannot look. So there's this place that women aren't supposed to be able to see. It's like and only a dude can see into it. So I was like, all right, whatever about that.
Yeah.
But so they're trying to breed the Kwisatz Haderach. He gets onto Dune and they're looking for the Lisan al-Ghaib, who is the voice of the outer world, who's like their messiah, who's supposed to lead them out of bondage because they're all the people, native Iraqis are Iraqis. You know, there's a lot of similarities, just like it kind of happened once. But all the people on Arrakis, like the natives, are being repressed by the Harkonnens, and they're being repressed by the Empire, and they're being hunted down and killed because they happen to live on a planet where there's a lot of spice. So I've watched both of the movies like 5 times this week. I've read the book more than once, and I'm still trying to get like what it is. And the only thing that I can think is that it touches on a little bit of everything that fascinates people. This concept of this shadow company, like the Chome company that controls like oil or controls travel. Then you have this imperial side to it that's super brutal, really violent. Like the Baron Harkonnen, it's like this brutal, violent, murderous man. So is the Emperor. And then you have these Bene Gesserit witches, and everybody loves witches. Like everybody loves that magical element to it. And you have this huge Messiah story. And this was back before people were doing Messiah stories, like way before Neo was the one. Like this was like, Dune was one of the first stories to really capitalize on this Messiah idea. And so I think that putting all of this stuff together in such a unique way has made it this enduring book, but I'm still having a really hard time figuring out exactly how it fits in to the lexicon of science fiction. Like I still haven't figured out what that thing is.
Sounds like a Comic-Con convention, you know, topic of conversation for like a keynote speaker.
The remake just came out, right? Or it's coming out?
Yeah, that's why I got into it. That's why I was like, oh, I'm going to reread that. Yeah. I'm going to get, because I saw the movie and I was like, dang it, that was beautiful filmmaking. And I was like, I got to reread that book.
My daughter went to see it with her friends because she loved the book and she just loved the movie. But she said her friends were like, what just happened? Because they hadn't read the book. They were like, what was that about?
It's a really confusing storyline. And in the movie, in this movie, you don't quite know yet that it's a Messiah story. Like now we can sort of talk about what it is. It's like, we know it's the sci-fi Messiah story. It's a space opera. We can categorize it kind of in that way, but it's not. It's also this story about ecology. And he talks about that a lot. And he's talking a lot about what it is to make and to destroy a planet and how easy it is for human beings to come in and monkey with that and tip the balance.
That's really timely to talk about. I mean,
there are so many things in this that are prescient. Like really the fight for oil, the fight for spice, the whoever controls the spice controls the universe. And that's like one of the main things about the book. And it's sort of like he hit on that long before people were talking about what it is to, you know, have a war over oil. And we had one.
I would like to reread that when I have some time to do that, like to really sit down and enjoy it.
Yeah.
So I don't want to read it. Is that a bad thing?
No, that's not bad. It's not everybody's cup of tea for sure.
It really isn't. And Alyssa, there are so many parts in it that would scare you or there are parts of it that are super like needlessly, grossly violent and dark. And there are parts where I'm just kind of like, is he enjoying writing that? Like, I don't know. You know, it's kind of like violence porn at a certain point.
Right.
Where, I don't know. It just goes a little far. Mm-hmm. I know he's trying to make a point, but. And another thing about this book is it was in the era before editors became super involved with science fiction. Like, you guys were talking earlier about how with Lord of the Flies, he was like, the editors were so involved with the process that he almost didn't recognize the book anymore.
Right.
And that it was exactly the opposite with science fiction, especially if you didn't go through Tor, which was pretty much one of the only big sci-fi imprints. But if you went through one of these super small imprints, there was no editor. Mm. They basically were like, and it's published exactly as you wrote it, because we'll just look through it for spelling errors and that'll be it. And this book needed an editor. Like, if this book had had an editor, it probably would, it would have like much more focus, and it would be much, there would have been a lot of things taken out that I thought went a little too far. So Alyssa, it would definitely scare you.
Okay.
I think.
I can't tell you why I enjoyed that book so much when I read it. I don't know. Mm. When I finished it, I thought that was amazing. But
yeah.
But I don't know. I couldn't tell you why. That was not something I normally would have read. It just envelops you.
I was just thinking about Josie, how you said there's no real structure to it and they could have used a better editor or whatever. But how, as an author, like, he created an entire world and characters and ideology. So how do you do that without being really like Josephine Angelini disciplined, where you have an outline and you have structure, you know, exactly? Because it just seems like that's so much to create.
First of all, it needed to be two books. Like, that first book is just, it's like, the fact that Villeneuve decided to split it into two movies at the perfect point.
Okay, so, you know, the Lord of the Rings series by Tolkien. I mean, were those heavily edited, or is that like something that just didn't happen back then?
It didn't happen back then.
Yeah, those long trilogies. Because I was going to say, like, how would you ever edit Tolkien's work? You couldn't.
Well, and how did that change? Because actually, I Am the Cheese, the author mentioned it, finally got published, and it was barely changed from what he had written. Like, the editor had a couple of minor suggestions. So at what point did editors start getting so heavy music? It seems like that would have a huge impact on what we're reading.
Some are and some aren't. So some editors are just like, we're not publishing this book if you have this part in it, period. Take it or leave it. We already own your book. You've already signed the deal. You've already taken the advance money, and they can simply not put your book out, and your book will never hit the shelves if they put their foot down like that. I've never been put into a position where I've had to make that kill switch choice, like, fine, then don't publish my book. Like, I've never had that problem. I've been lucky enough to work with people who wanted the book that I wrote. They just wanted to make it better. It sounds to me like with Lord of the Flies, they saw great writing there, but they were like, this is not a story I can sell, but I want to help this writer. I want to get this writer going. So they're like, okay, I'll buy the book, but this book is unpublishable as it is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just not going to find an audience.
But it's like any creative endeavor. It's so subjective. So, I mean, do you have, as a writer, do you have any say in who your editor is? Do you get to choose the type of person who critiques your work?
No, usually you don't. That's when a really good agent comes in handy. So a really good agent will say, bring your work to a specific editor at a specific imprint and say, this book is for you because you're the right person to pull this off. I've always been lucky enough that my work went to somebody who wanted it as it was, but it just needed work.
Interesting.
Is there a difference between like your very first book and how many notes you had on it versus now? Like, do you think you've gotten better as a writer? Like,
oh, definitely. One of my goals as a writer was I wanted to get better at the craft of writing with every book. Like, that I wanted to learn. That's how I go into my notes. Like, whenever I get a note on a book, even if I'm like, oh, you're missing the point, you're not seeing what I was trying to do, I go, they're not seeing what I was trying to do. How do I make it clear to the reader so they can see what I'm trying to do? Instead of getting defensive about it, what I try to do, even though it's always emotional when you get notes and you always like have this knee-jerk reaction to protect your work, there's a reason that note is there. That person's trying to make this book better. And if you want to be a better writer, you got to strip your ego away and say that I didn't accomplish what I wanted to accomplish. Now, how do I do it? Mm. And you have to figure it out. And that's just craft writing. That's, you know, going to school. It's hard. So Aileen, can you tell us some final thoughts on your wonderful, fantastic book, The Chocolate War?
No, I'm just kidding. it's a brilliantly written book about how cruel and awful boys can be to each other. And I think he uses boys, but I think really humans in general can be really nasty and get caught up in groupthink and just being mean to each other. But yeah, it's just, it's well written. It's interesting. It'll kind of make you think. And if you have teeth foil, it'll definitely make you think. So I recommend it.
Cool. Alyssa, can you give us some final thoughts on Lord of the Flies?
Everything Aileen just said. I mean, that's really, the books are so similar. Group of isolated boys, savage instincts, well-written, great imagery, will leave you disturbed. yeah, recommend.
And Lauren, your beach read.
My palate cleanser read. I'm just, I'm pro escapist reading. Yeah, you should all do it.
I do, Lauren.
You should not read Lord of the Rings. You should read things like fluff. Read fluff. It's good for the brain.
What was the title of it again?
Season for Second Chances by Jenny Bayless.
And my final thoughts on Dune are, I'm still thinking about it. This book is so complicated. It touches so many themes in society, in politics, in religion, in our destiny as human beings, like our evolution. It's just, there's so many different levels to this book that I'm probably going to be thinking about it for a really long time. And I definitely recommend it for anyone who is up for a 200,000 word book. Do not drop it on your big toe.
Ouch.
Wait, let me tell you one exciting thing that happened to me today.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Let us hear.
It's not really that exciting, but first of all, Wyatt called me lazy because we were reading a book and we're lazy.
That's my mother once.
And so Wyatt's like, what does lazy mean? And Ralph's like, well, it's when somebody just wants to lay around and do nothing. And then Ralph decided to ask him, do you think mommy is lazy? And Wyatt looked at me and he said, yes. And so I said, do you think daddy is lazy?
No.
And he said, no. And I was like, okay, motherfucker, we're going for a hike today. So I'm like, daddy's going to sit on the couch and watch football and we're going to go for a hike. So we went for a hike, which is always interesting with like a 4.5-year-old because you're like, I can't go too far. Like you always have to do the math and be like, if we go this far, would I be able to carry him back when he has a tantrum and refuses to start walking? Like, anyways, we were walking. It's like in a reservation in New Jersey and he ran up to this couple and asked if he could pet their dog. And they're like, oh, yeah, of course. And I went to say, oh, thank you, and pet the dog. And I looked up and it was Zach Braff and Florence Pugh.
Oh, cool. Oh, my gosh.
Lauren, you look so tired.
I know. I did all this yard work today. I'm exhausted. Fall in New England.
Okay. So I guess that's it for episode 4, season 1 of Fiction Between Friends. Thank you so much, you guys.
It was fun.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Talk to you next week.
You've been listening to Fiction Between Friends. To find the show notes for this episode or to subscribe and get new episodes delivered automatically, visit fictionbetweenfriends.com. Also, if you happen to have a moment and you've liked what you've heard, please help support our podcast by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. We would be immensely grateful. Thank you for listening.